KPFK for information, insightful reporting, so please don't take coverage like this for granted. It's here for you thanks to the generous financial support of our listeners. Support the programming you rely on right now by calling 818-985-5735 or contribute online at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Madam Walker is very much a part of the telling of the history of Indianapolis. So she is woven into the narratives.
That's Alelia Bundles.
I am a journalist. I am a former network television news executive and producer. And I'm also Madam C.J. Walker's great-great-granddaughter and biographer.
Miss Bundles has written the authoritative biography of Madam C.J. Walker. If your school ever taught about famous African Americans, you may remember learning about her. She was born Sarah Breedlove in 1867.
She was orphaned at 7, married at 14, she said, to get away from a cruel brother-in-law who abused her, had a child at 17, and her first husband, Moses McWilliams, died when she was 20.
Sarah Breedlove's life was full of challenges, big and small.
It's hard for us to think about just what life was like in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when most Americans didn't have indoor plumbing, which meant hygiene was very different. People might bathe only once a week. They might not wash their hair except once a month, sometimes not at all during the winter. And as a result, many people had very bad scalp infections, and that was what was plaguing Sarah Breedlove McWilliams.
Her hair began to fall out. But Sarah quickly came up with a solution, literally.
She developed a hair care product, a formula that restored her hair, healed scalp disease, began selling it. She moved from St. Louis to Denver, worked for a pharmacist as a cook, and got some ideas for perfecting her formula.
While in Denver, Sarah Breedlove McWilliams became Madam C.J. Walker. She founded her company and got to work.
She would have said the first thing you have to have is a really great product, and then you have to market it. She marketed it with advertisements, with training people, and then began to sell it, began to travel all over the United States.
She wasn't just selling products. She was spreading the word about Black excellence to Black Americans.
She even had an early version of PowerPoint. It was a stereopticon glass slides with a projector. She was showing pictures of successful Black businesses and colleges and schools, and she would draw a crowd, and maybe 10 or 12 women would meet later with her because they were interested in becoming her agents.
She briefly relocated to Pittsburgh.
And then moved their headquarters to Indianapolis in 1910.
Madam Walker set up her factory along Indiana Avenue, the main street of Indianapolis's biggest Black neighborhood, and bought a home about a block away. From her headquarters, Madame Walker presided over a veritable hair care empire, employing thousands and making millions. By the time she died in 1919, she'd become America's first self-made woman millionaire. Her success established Madame Walker as a big deal in her adopted city. The Indianapolis Historical Society has one of the biggest Madam C.J. Walker collections in the world, and it frequently hosts exhibits about her. So I went to Indianapolis to check one out.
All right, I'm at the Historical Society, the Indianapolis Historical Society.
Once there, I saw maps, descriptive texts,
and a recreation of her office, complete with a big desk, mirror, and a safe for all of Madam's money. I even ran into an actor portraying a Walker Company sales agent from back in the day.
I don't have to go door-to-door because Madam Walker knows so many people here in Indianapolis.
After the exhibit, I walked upstairs to the office of Susan Hall Dotson, who curates the Historical Society's African American collections.
Hey, Deca. Welcome. Welcome back.
Susan had a lot to show me. Newspaper clippings, postcards, and advertisements from the archives covered her desk.
Walker newsletter from 1928, and it talks about how she got to Indianapolis.
Susan helped to put together the exhibit that I had seen. So I asked her how she and her colleagues had decided what to display.
Initially, a discussion was had about, well, maybe we should do it in the kitchen where she was making her product. And I go, no, that's not the story for Indiana. When she moved here, she was building and buying a small factory. She had trucks with her name on it. Why should we keep being in the kitchen as women, as black women, particularly when we don't have to?
By the time Madam Walker arrived in Indianapolis, she had already succeeded. She had money, power, and friends in high places.
It would be easy to assume that it was only Madam's wealth and energy that made Indiana Avenue the vibrant, prosperous community it once was in the early 1900s.
It turns out, though, that Indiana Avenue was thriving way before Madam Walker made it her home. It was the equivalent of New York City's Harlem or Tulsa's Greenwood.
Few people alive today know that. Because over decades, government planners and private developers slowly and systematically erased Indiana Avenue's history.
But some Black Hoosiers are working to uncover and reclaim what almost disappeared without a trace.
Welcome to Urban Roots, a podcast from Urbanist Media that dives into little-known stories from urban history.
We're your hosts. I'm City's journalist, Vanessa Quirk.
And I'm historic preservationist Dara Hussein Wetzel. Today, we're in Indianapolis.
In this first of two episodes, we'll tell you more about Madam C.J. Walker and her journey to Indy. And we'll share the fuller story of the place that helped buoy her prosperity and cement her legacy.
The rise and fall of Indiana Avenue.
Let's not wait until these neighborhoods are dead and gone to start valuing them.
That's artist, historian, and activist Wildstyle Pichelle. He has a personal connection to Indiana Avenue.
Both sides of my family, my mom and dad's side, either lived there or worked there or owned businesses there.
And this is Claudia.
Claudia Pauly, born and raised in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Claudia and Wildstyle know a lot about the history of 19th and 20th century Indianapolis, especially along Indiana Avenue.
Indianapolis has four arms, if you will, these spokes coming out from the center of town. Indiana Avenue is one of them. Virginia Avenue, Kentucky Avenue, Massachusetts Avenue is the other.
Right.
Two southern states, two northern.
It was not a slave state, but for many years it was a sundown state where Blacks were not allowed to actually live by constitutional decree for a long time.
That changed with the Emancipation Proclamation.
After the Civil War, Blacks were allowed to have businesses and homes.
The first Black business opened around 1865 or 1866 on Indiana Avenue.
City officials allowed African Americans and Eastern Europeans to settle and open businesses along Indiana Avenue because, well, it wasn't pleasant.
It was very swampy. Mm-hmm. It was filled with mosquitoes. It was not the preferred place to live. So the non-preferred people lived here.
Indiana Avenue was actually called the Negro Meridian Street because that was the center, like literally the center of Black culture in Indianapolis.
From that point on, through the early 1900s, Indiana Avenue attracted more and more Black folks and grew into its own as a community.
Before and after Madam Walker arrived in 1910, African Americans could spend money, earn money, and create a good life in this neighborhood. So let's now unpack why Madam chose Indianapolis as her company's home and explore how it changed Indiana history.
As her company grew, Madam needed a strategic location. Indianapolis, the crossroads of America, was the perfect choice. Walker descendant and historian Alelia Bundles.
Thousands of train cars, freight cars and passenger cars, went through its train station each week. And so for somebody like Madam Walker, who had a primarily mail order business, it was a great location. And she saw that the Black community was progressive with newspapers and businesses. So with these newspapers and with these trains, she could take out advertisements in the Indianapolis Freeman, and she could be assured that the Pullman porters who came through the city every day could pick up a stack of the newspapers and sell them, and her ads would be wherever they went, whether it was Boston or San Francisco or Detroit or Atlanta.
Plus, Madam Walker had a deep well of Black talent she could tap into in her new hometown.
Her bookkeeper was a Black woman who had had the highest score on the civil service exam in Indiana, who wanted to work in Washington at the War Department. But when the War Department discovered that she was Black, they weren't interested in hiring her. Madam Walker was delighted to hire this very smart young woman.
Her brain trust also included a brilliant attorney named F.B. Ransom. Alice Kelly, who had worked as a dean of girls at a private Black boarding school, managed her factory.
She could trust that the T's would be crossed and the I's would be dotted at home, at the factory, at the headquarters, while she traveled around.
The people who worked for Madam Walker knew they were making history, so they were conscientious about maintaining the reputation and preserving the legacy of the company and its leader after her death in 1919.
Today, we have more than 40,000 documents, business records, personal letters, photographs, advertisements that really tell us what was going on with the company, and we're able to tell her story in detail.
Can you see her impact on the physical landscape of Indianapolis?
So fortunately, the Madam Walker Legacy Center, which was the headquarters of Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company, is still standing. It was built in 1927 after Madam Walker's death, but there is very little along Indiana Avenue of those original buildings.
We are just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. Today's episode is from our podcast partners at Urbanist Media, and you can find links to their show on our website, which you should also visit if you'd like more information about today's episode or if you'd like to leave us a message. And now, back to the show.
The theater is the only building connected to Madam that still remains, so I knew I had to go see it and the Avenue myself.
Thank you for letting me come check this building out.
Yeah, absolutely.
I knocked on the door and was greeted by a smiling Devin Ginn, the manager of outreach and programs for the Walker Legacy Center.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Devin walked me towards the main stage.
Follow me this way into the theater.
Careful.
Oh my.
Let me get these lights on.
Wow.
Yes.
It's gorgeous.
The theater was spacious, filled with lush red velvet seats. African art covered the walls.
Authentic East African art deco, hand-carved terracotta with Yoruba and Egyptian motifs. Alelia Walker, who was known as the joy goddess of the Harlem Renaissance back in the day, she wanted to really honor her mom's legacy and, you know, the connection to Pan-African history.
Devin told me that plans for this structure started when Madam was still alive. Originally, the building wasn't meant to be a theater at all.
The original intent was for this to be a factory.
But then something happened to Madam Walker that made her think twice.
There's a now-defunct theater, Isis Theater, 10 cents to see a film to get a ticket. She had her 10 cents ready, made it to the ticket booth, and the ticket teller said, you know what, it's an N-word tax, it's a Black tax, so you've got to pay 25 cents, which is more than double what she was anticipating paying. So from then on, she endeavored to build something for her people, by her people. Add the component of, you know, the large stage and let this be a place where Black folk can come and view films as well.
The kind of discrimination that Madam experienced was commonplace at that time. In fact, throughout the early 1900s and into the 20s, the Ku Klux Klan became a potent force in Indianapolis. Historian Wildstyle Pichelle.
The Ku Klux Klan actually ran the city and the state of Indiana at that time. I've heard from several elders that talk about the Klan marching down Indiana Avenue, basically, you know, letting people know who's really in charge of the city.
The Klan enforced segregation by building the all-black Crispus Attucks High School, half a mile north of Indiana Avenue.
Before that, the schools weren't, I'm not going to say they were integrated, but there were blacks that went to other schools. But the day they opened that high school, it didn't matter where you lived at in the city, you were expected to go there.
Preservationist Claudia Polly remembers that for many kids, getting to Crispus Attucks involved hardship every day. Most walked because they couldn't afford bus fare.
But the quality of the education they received was far from poor.
Crispus Attucks was pretty well known throughout the country because all of the teachers there had been recruited specifically by the inaugural principal. My grandmother was one of the teachers in that extraordinary music department. The only woman, so you know how good she had to be. Mm-hmm. Wes Montgomery, J.J. Johnson, they all studied classical music at Crispus Attucks High School long before they went into jazz.
With its high-quality teachers, Crispus Attucks produced not just musicians, but lawyers, accountants, and business people.
In other words, Indianapolis's black residents turned an injustice into an opportunity to thrive. And they did the same on Indiana Avenue.
A lot of people think it was all jazz. No, that was business. We had many doctors and lawyers, photographers, and there were artists, and there were teachers all over the area.
Devin Ginn of the Walker Theater told me that if I really wanted to understand what the Avenue was like in its heyday, there was one man I had to talk to. His name?
Thomas Howard Ridley. I was born and raised a block and a half from Indiana Avenue. That was back in 1922.
Mr. Ridley knows a lot about Indiana Avenue. In fact, he wrote the book on it.
And it's called From the Avenue. I was on the Avenue. Back in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s.
Did you ever go to the Walker Theater?
Go to it. I was there when it opened.
Wow.
When I was a teenager, we liked to get dressed up and go stand on the Walker Corner and look at the girls. And they would come down dressed in their little dresses. I remember catching a streetcar on Northwestern Avenue and riding down to the Walker. And there'd be half a dozen friends of mine was on that streetcar with me.
The Walker Theater wasn't the only entertainment venue in the area, but it was the classiest.
There was a need for a theater, a nice theater like that. There was a need for a nice restaurant like the coffee pot lounge, which was in the basement. There was a need for offices for some of the doctors and lawyers that moved into the building.
According to Mr. Ridley, the Avenue was the place to see and be seen.
Coming to the Avenue was a big thing to do.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fun drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. If you believe in radio not sponsored by corporations, but sponsored by you, the people, please call and make your pledge at 818-985-5735. That is 818-985-5735. Peace and love.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
There's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and see what we are capable of.
Afrofuturism is a genre movement rooting elements of science fiction and fantasy in traditions from Africa and the diaspora, and its popularity as a form of resistance is on the rise. But Afrofuturist concepts have been prevalent in music and literature since the 1950s. You've got jazz musician Sun Ra and authors Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler.
The surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world. And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing, black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing.
On this episode, authors Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez sit down with John Jennings at the San Francisco Public Library as part of the 2016 Black Comics Festival. They discuss the role of Afrofuturist thought in the modern context and the importance of allowing ourselves to imagine.
When I sit down to write, I don't think I'm an Afrofuturist writer, I'm going to write an Afrofuturist whatever.
Nalo Hopkinson.
I'll happily claim the adjective. It happened after I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. It is a label that people use to try and pull together a pattern that they're seeing. And in so much as what it is, it's useful. Mm-hmm. But it is also not as simple as I'm just a writer. Of course, I'm not just a writer. I am everything that I am. But the Afrofuturism part is it's got to be somewhere else when I write, or it will stop me. I'm writing science fiction fantasy, so there's a lot of research that goes into it, and a lot of, not just research, but theorizing, because of course the history books leave stuff out. So you have to imagine yourself into those places. I'm researching the future, I'm researching the past, I'm researching black history, Caribbean history, white history. I barely stayed awake through history class when I was in school. And now, if you look at my shelves, that stuff is all over the place. And I discover the more I go into it, the more I realize that human beings are human beings. You can reach back into the very beginning of time when human beings are human beings, and we aren't that different. And there's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and African cultures and African ways of life and see that what we are capable of, which, you know, but to see it proven over and over and over and over again as the centuries go by and the centuries go forward.
I definitely look into my past.
Nnedi Okorafor.
I am what I consider Niger-American, which means Niger is slang for Nigerian, and I'm American. So Nigerian-American. I was born and raised in this country, but from a young age, my parents were taking me back to, my siblings and I, back to Nigeria to reconnect with our heritage, reconnect with our family. Most of our family is there. And then also just being Nigerian American in the house, within that culture, within the Igbo culture, those old traditions and ways have seeped into who I am as well. So those all manifest themselves. My Nigerian-Americanness definitely manifests itself in my work. I deal a lot with the traditional spiritualities, especially of the Igbo people, but of other parts of the continent as well. One example are masquerades. Masquerades show up in my works a lot. Masquerades are found in many different African cultures, but I have like a lot of what I write about comes from personal experience. So my personal experience with masquerades. Masquerades are like they are manifestations of the dead and the ancestors and spirits. And there are many different types. Some can look very monstrous, like, you know, just raffia and cloth that they can look like monsters. And those are the ones that I've been obsessed with. And so when I was a kid, whenever we'd go back to Nigeria, the masquerades would come out around Christmas time, that's a whole other issue. You come out around Christmas time, and because my sisters and I were American Nigerians, they would harass us the most. And they would literally chase us down the street. Okay, they would chase us. They had like a whip, and they would whip people, and they would chase us down the street with the whip. And luckily, we were fast, so we weren't caught too many times. So when I think back, I'm like, okay. And a lot of times we would outrun them. And so when I think back, I'm like, oh, I was outrunning the spirits. And so in my own stories, you see the masquerade show up a lot in my stories, and they show up in a way they show up in the way that I imagine them, because I've seen the really big, terrifying ones at weddings, and all the women just run to the other side of the room. It's just, it's really quite epic. And in my stories, because I'm writing speculative fiction, I can imagine those masquerades the way I see them, which is as they're not people or men in particular dressed up in these elaborate costumes who then take on the ancestor or the spirit. They are that creature. Mm. And so in my stories, I can do that. I can show them that way. And I have a lot of fun with it. So I do look in the past.
I would love to hear if people have specifics about what prompted them to write their first.
Jewel Gomez.
Mine was based on a very specific incident that happened to me in the mid-80s. Does anybody here remember telephone booths? Okay. I was in a telephone booth at the corner of my street. I guess my phone wasn't working or I had rebelled and not paid the bill. But so I was in the phone booth, and these two guys walked by me and went into their whole thing. Oh, baby, let me suck your blah, 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 and I want to do this to you, and oh, you're looking so good, as if that would interest me, their opinion. And I was talking to my friend, Marianne, and she said, what's going on? I said, hold on a second. I turned and looked at them, and I said, please go away. And then I turned back to Marianne. Well, of course, they didn't go away. They just went on and on. I said, hold on. I turned around. I said, motherfucker, I will kill you if you don't get a with me. And one of the guys said, this is crazy. And the other guy was just like, kept on going. I said, yes, I am crazy, and I will kill you. And used a lot of that language that my grandmother had asked me not to use. And the one guy dragged the other guy away. Wow. And this was on West End Avenue and 93rd Street in Manhattan. My adrenaline had gone through my body like crazy. I was so happy there was nothing at hand for me to pick up.
Right.
Because they keep West End Avenue kind of clean. My friend, Marianne, I heard her screaming, Jewel, 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 because she thought I was killing someone. So I said, Marianne, I can't talk. I have to go home. I can't talk. So I went home, and I caught my breath, and I sat down, and I wrote the first Gilda story.
Mm. Wow.
And it was a woman walking in on the street, and a guy does that to her, and of course she kills him.
I'm so going to use that when I teach the Gilda stories.
Tosses his body in the river. So I decided I better use my powers for good.
Please.
And over time, you know, evolved the vampire mythology. because that's really what I realized I was working on, so that she didn't have to kill people and develop the whole philosophy around it. So that fit into my political, mm-hmm. social political philosophy mm-hmm. as a lesbian feminist. And I felt like, you know, the surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world.
Right.
And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing as opposed to, you know, killing people on the street.
I keep going back to Walter Mosley, who you may or may not know. Has written science fiction novels and short stories.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. All right.
And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he basically said we need a better world, and in order to have a better world, in order to make it, we first need to be able to imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
And also Samuel R. Delaney, mentor of mine, who said we need visions of the future, and our people need them more than most.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
It was true then, true now. And so there is very much a connection. And I sort of also think, yeah, the work is there. The work needs to be done. It's desperate. But we also need to be able to enjoy, to have fun, to have imagination, to have passion, because why else are we doing this? So I think we also need to give ourselves permission to enjoy. The work is there and we will do it. So there's very much a connection between allowing ourselves to imagine,
mm-hmm.
allowing ourselves to think that we get to, like anybody else, have fun,
mm-hmm.
And using that to fuel the vision of what it is we're trying to make. Sometimes I just want to write strange stories set in strange places. My own reality will always seep into those stories. But I want to hold on to the fact that we get to do all of it.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the word using these narratives for social justice,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very resistant to that.
Yeah.
Because I know that when I sit down and to write something, I'm not thinking that, okay, I want to make this point. You know, this is something I want to show the world about whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes down to it, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just letting it flow. I'm a very subconscious writer where oftentimes I don't even have an outline. Mm-hmm. I don't even know who the character is. I'll just sit down and just start.
Right.
And whatever is flowing through me is what will flow through me. So the idea of using the narrative for something is foreign to me. I mean, I understand other writers, other artists who operate like that, but for me, I definitely don't. But I do know that I'm very much a political person. So those ideas and what I want to see, the changes that I want to see and the things that I want to do and want to see done, those are already there. Those are things that I might have conversations about when I'm not writing. But when I sit down to write, those things come through in a more indirect way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I deal with my books tend to be very political, and it's not that I sat down and thought, okay, I want to write this political story. It's just that they are because I am.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I might be a little more conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I start out to write agitprop, but having come of age, you know, in the civil rights movement, the black arts movement, all of the work that people were doing was an expression of liberation and opening new worlds to us, the worlds of blackness. So I think I started writing in a very conscious way about blackness, mm-hmm. the same as being a feminist. I started writing very consciously about women and how women are placed in the world. At the same time, I don't want to write a tract.
Right.
You know, so people will just, you know, snore. But I think though, having come of age in those particular movements make me much more conscious of it as I'm doing it. And I think that's one of the interesting things for this, going from African-Americans saying, how dare you write a vampire novel with African-Americans in it? How could you do that? How could you connect those things? To see the community come full circle and say, oh yeah, we're going to claim this and we're going to give it its own name, Afrofuturism. You know, it's really great. And in part, I think that's because the political evolution on campuses, in communities, poorer communities who are starting to understand their economics has to be taken in their own hands.
Right.
They can't wait for the government to fix it. That racism, sexism, any of the isms really need to be in our hands. How we fight them need to be in our hands. And I think that is a sign of hope. And I think that's one of the reasons that our writing has started to spread out into these fields, into black comics, into future Afrofuturism, and other speculative fictions. I think it's a sign of hope.
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice. And feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM. And kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
As a KPFK listener, you expect to hear smart conversations about important issues every time you turn on the radio. We bring you facts and analysis, not partisanship or hype, so you can form your own opinions on the news. You count on KPFK for informed, insightful reporting. Don't take coverage like this for granted. It's here for you, thanks to the generous financial support of our listeners. Support the programming you rely on right now by calling 818-985-5735 or contribute online at kpfk.org.
I'm Anita Johnson. Ever since the first Africans were brought to North America on cargo ships, black women have helped build this country, now known as the United States of America. While black women have played a critical role in the development of our nation, their stories, our stories, have been overlooked and intentionally left out of history books. In the new book, A Black Woman's History of the United States, historians Dr. Dinah Rami Berry and Dr. Callie Nicole Gross honor the many significant contributions of Black women who have worked tirelessly to build this country and fight for social justice in the face of racism and sexism. Today, we'll learn about some of these amazing women.
There was no way we could write a book and not feature Shirley Chisholm. Mm-hmm. Unbought and unbossed.
What I like about her is her speech when she does the acceptance speech, or when she says that she's going to be the nominee. She's running for president. She makes that announcement, and she says, "I'm not the candidate for Black America, although I'm Black. I'm not the candidate for the women's America, although I'm a woman. I'm a candidate." There's another sentence, and then she says, "I'm the candidate for the people of America." And it's just a really powerful moment. And it just reminds me of the level of activism. When we look at Black women last year on the campaign trail, we look at the number of Black women that were being considered for the vice presidency. And we have a Black and South Asian woman now, Vice President Harris. So that you just think about that. And I think about Shirley Chisholm sort of paving the way for these contemporary women. And so we had to include her in here.
That's Dr. Dinah Rami Berry. She, along with Dr. Kylie Nicole Gross, joined KPFA's moderator, Sabrina Jacobs, for an insightful conversation about the Black women activists, trailblazers, and others who have left a notable mark on this country. Dr. Kylie Nicole Gross.
So in thinking about how we're going to do this, right? On one hand, we know that Black women and Black women's experiences, they're not a monolith. Right. And we wanted to make sure that we talked about all kinds of Black women, from enslaved women to free women, women in rural parts of the country, women from the South, in urban areas, the North, Midwest, West Coast, you name it, all walks of life. But in spite of all of their differences, there are a number of themes that seem to impact Black women's experiences in broadly. And so we decided that this would also be some of the organizing principles for the book. And you see them here laid out. Travel, motion, and migration is a huge aspect of Black women's experiences, whether that's forced migration, whether Black women chose, elected to leave, but, you know, I say voting with their feet, right? Taking advantage, you know. Violence is obviously an inescapable aspect of Black womanhood. We looked at that in a lot of ways, certainly physical violence, sexual violence, but also thinking too about representational violence, the ways that Black women are caricatured and ridiculed, also the violence of poverty. The other theme we worked on was certainly activism is a central facet. From the first sister who, you know, chose to come, you know, and on an exploration, which Dinah will talk more about, right up until today, Black women have been demanding justice, have been decrying inequity, and are fierce advocates and will stand up and organize. Labor and entrepreneurship are also vital aspects. And again, we try to approach that broadly, thinking about their experiences with respect to enslavement, but also ways that they branched out and tried to cultivate their own careers to escape agricultural labor and domestic service and other kinds of labor that was exploitative even after enslavement. The other big sort of change, not change, but one of the other streams that we really wanted to incorporate is looking at criminalization and incarceration. I think a lot of times when we think about these issues around justice and mass incarceration, we tend to approach this as something that uniquely happens to Black men. And one of the things that we find in history is that Black women were actually more disproportionately overrepresented in the justice system than Black men. And that's something that begins in the North, almost from the country's founding, when they gradually, you know, phase out enslavement. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the whole country, including the South, once we have the Civil War. So that was a key piece to also sort of really tease out too, to see how deeply embedded these biases and misogynoir really is in the country. But at the same time, you know, we didn't want to put together a history that would be sort of just this one-sided kind of slog through violence and terror and tyranny. We also wanted to capture Black women's vibrancy, that spirit, the passion that keeps folks going. So we also focused on art, performance, creativity. And this is all throughout the book, throughout all these different aspects of history. So not just as soon as we get to like 1975, or you know, all of a sudden we're talking about artists or something. No, artists are in the antebellum period. They are in the late 19th century, the early 20th century, you know, creativity, performance, all these things to just sort of highlight the ways that people indulge and express themselves and also a love for their Black womanhood. And then, of course, in thinking about sex and sexuality, we wanted to explore pleasure, right? That we talk a lot about sex and violence and terror and these things that happen to Black women. We know a lot about Black women's bodies as victimized bodies, but we also wanted to explore Black womanhood's experience with respect to sexuality and the erotic, and also too with different sexual identities. So we took pains to make sure that we represented the experiences of Black queer women, and again, throughout history. So we don't wait until we get into the 70s to start talking about Black lesbians. We talk about Black queer experiences in the antebellum period, the late 19th century, the 20th century, right up to. So these are sort of the central themes that we structure the book around, and what we sort of took pains to accomplish.
And Dinah, Dr. Berry, would you like to go ahead and answer? We've already got a question here. So.
Yeah. So we had a question that from Lavinia Harrison asking, why is family or motherhood not included as a central theme? It's actually not listed as a central theme, but it is absolutely a theme that is throughout the entire book. And one of the things that we will talk about is all of the mothers that we write about in the book that really did phenomenal things under extreme duress and stress. The women that raised children after being the product of rape during slavery, the women and mothers like Mamie Till Mobley, who had the open casket for her son, Emmett Till, which we'll talk about. And we talk about the mothers of the conjoined twins, Millie and Christine McCoy. So mothers are there. We just didn't have it listed as a theme, but there's no way when you read the book that you'll see that motherhood and family is absolutely a central theme. We just used the ones that Dr. Gross was talking about. That was how we sort of framed the argument. We knew we needed to talk about those. We try to talk about each of those in every chapter, and motherhood was just naturally there. So hopefully that answers your question. And I don't know if you wanted to add to that, Kelly, or anything.
No, I mean, I would agree. I think that is, in some respects, right. It was sort of naturally there and throughout. And it comes and occurs through all of the stories and many, many of the chapters.
And one thing I always say, because my area of expertise is slavery, is that you know, not all women, even in the post-slavery era, even today, not all women choose to be mothers, not all women want to be mothers. And so we always leave a space for that as well. Or some women were forced to be mothers and not really, you know, and having to raise children that they struggled with raising. So there's that, when we talk about motherhood, we have to look at all the complexities of it and some of the challenges there. So I want to jump to Isabel de Oliveira, who opens up the first chapter. And she is a figure who we did about a year of research on to find out who this woman was. We were trying to figure out, where do we start this book? Where do we start in 1619 with the first ship that came, that we talk about all the time, that now lots of people know about? Or do we go a little bit earlier? Are there women of African descent that were here earlier? And if so, where were they? What were they doing? What are their stories? Isabel de Oliveira is one such woman who we were very happy to write about, and other scholars have written about her as well. She was a woman of both African and Indian descent. She lived in Mexico, and she wanted to go on an expedition to travel with a number of other explorers that were going into what now is, it was New Spain. It's called New Spain, but it's present day New Mexico. And she had to file a petition with the local government, and she had to then have witnesses to testify to whom she was and that she was valid. And that they could validate her going. And she was asking and demanding and requesting a piece of paper to show that she was a free woman and that she was bound neither by marriage nor slavery, and that she could go on this expedition and that people would not bother her. And she wanted to have this documentation to carry with her as sort of that authentication paperwork. so that no one would bother her, because she knew that people would be disturbed, as she says, disturbed by her being a mulatta. So that was, that's her. And at the end, she says, you know, I'm going on an expedition and have reason to fear that I may be annoyed. I may be annoyed by some individual since I am a mulatta. I demand justice. And as Dr. Gross was saying a few minutes ago, Black women came to this country demanding justice before 1619. And that was really important for us to start with that time period and to start with a woman who was free, to show that, that Black people did not just come to this country enslaved, that they had lived in freedom and in spaces of freedom in all parts of the world, and that their captivity brought them to the United States as enslaved people, but not everybody came that way. So that was really important for us to start off with Isabel de Oliveira.
Dr. Dinah Rami Berry.
So when we go into the next section, this is more familiar. This is really where, if you've taken an African-American history class, this is where the textbooks often begin. They begin often in 1619. We've been hearing a lot about it over the last year because of the anniversary, the past anniversary or commemoration of the first arrival of 20-odd, the quote was 20-odd Negroes. So we looked at the women and one woman that was on that particular ship or those ships, and that was Angela. And we really went back to understand, like, where did she come from? What community did she live in? What was her capture like? What was her experience before she landed? Because most of what we know and most of what we teach is after the landing. But there's such a larger history of women on slave ships. And I want to just read a little section, just a quick section about what it might be like to be captured from the first chapter. Consider for a moment that the particular trauma of forced captivity for women. African girls and women might have been tended to children or engaged in other responsibilities in their villages with family and with friends when suddenly someone with a sackcloth on their head put a sackcloth on their heads and chains on their feet. They were violently taken and forced to walk to places that they did not know existed. When they arrived, some of them saw bodies of water that seemed to have no end. Even more frightening was the sight of their captors. This may have been the first time they saw people with white skin. Who were they? Ghosts, cannibals, evil spirits? Were their captors European or African? How did women make sense of the process of what was happening? Or did they process what was happening? In the midst of all of this confusion, they were forced to walk in quote unquote slave coffles, chained by neck or ankles to their captives, to other captives. Many of whom did not speak the same language, despite the commonality of their skin tone. Those being transported, they may not have been from the same community. African people came from thousands of different ethnicities and spoke a variety of languages. Barefoot and sometimes naked, they were put into holding facilities with cold concrete floors and walls that did not have windows, a suffocating ventilation system. Bodily fluids such as vomit, blood, urine, and feces caked the floor and the walls, and the stench was overwhelming. Shrieking sounds of distraught mothers, daughters, aunties, grandmothers, infants, moaning, crying, and screaming were ear-piercing and haunting. This was not a place anyone chose to visit nor cared to remember. It was a place that they all wanted to forget. So that is just a passage of some of the more difficult passages of the book. We actually, if you remember, we struggled. Some of our early openings were a little bit too heavy, and we had to back up. We want people to read the book, but there are some pieces in here and there's sections in here that are challenging. If you haven't read about the institution of slavery, if you don't know much about Black women's experience with incarceration, some of those sections are going to be challenging for the reader. But there's also, as Callie was saying, there's joy. There's moments of just great creativity and strength. So the whole gamut is in this book.
You've been listening to A Black Woman's History of the United States on Making Contact. Thanks to the authors, Dinah Rami Berry and Callie Nicole Gross. And thank you to KPFA for granting us use of this audio.
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button. Or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. We love doing that. We love teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students, to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA, but we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. So we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
The first time I heard KPFK, it was in the wee hours, maybe 2 a.m. Roy of Hollywood was on, right? And he was playing Alan Watts. And it was so surreal. I was like, what is this? What is this? What kind of radio is this? You know, I mean, it just blew my mind. And I got hooked right away.
KPFK.
Hi, I'm Andrea Martin. You might forget me from the 80s. KPFK is listener-supported public radio in Los Angeles that refuses to take money from corporations. They didn't refuse, however, to take money from me, and all I have left to show for it is a biodegradable tote bag to store all my other biodegradable tote bags in, and a bumper sticker, which they happily said was mine to enjoy. If only I hadn't donated my car to KPFK, I would have a bumper to stick it on. So please join me in showing your support by calling 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KAPUFKA or online kpfk.org. I'm Andrea Martin, and trust me, all the money you give goes directly toward keeping the lights on, and in my estimation, should be dimmer because these carpets haven't been cleaned since the 80s, which you might forget me from.
The following public service information comes from the Federal Emergency Management Agency News Desk. Heavy rain is coming to Los Angeles on Thursday evening, bringing 3 to 6 inches of rain and winds up to 30 miles an hour. If you live near recent wildfire areas like Pacific Palisades or Altadena, now is the time to prepare. Burn scars increase the risk of dangerous flooding and debris flows, which can carry hidden hazards and cause serious damage. Please don't wait for an emergency. Take action now. Get free sandbags at dpw.lacounty.gov, pack a go bag, and make an evacuation plan. Please stay informed by following local officials and emergency alerts and avoid floodwaters and debris. They can be dangerous. If authorities tell you